Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Francisco L. Borges and the Melville Charitable Trust.
Hello, hello. So, as I've probably referenced in the past, growing up, I was even as kind of a little kid, I was a comedy nerd. So much so that I think comedy spoke to me before almost any other form of culture. The notion of a comedian, a person whose job it was to make you laugh, it blew my mind. And so I tended to be the kind of little kid who was way more interested in which comedians were going to be on Ed Sullivan than, let's say, whether the Beatles were on. I realize that's kind of sad. And for that reason, I actually was able to watch, you know, kind of the entire career of George Carlin. I am old enough and nerdy enough to remember him with his crew cut and his suit and sometimes a kind of pair of Goldwater glasses being, you know, a pretty conventional comedian. Of course, that changed. It changed several times, as we are going to say here on the show today. To me, having watched the four-hour, partly directed by Judd Apatow, biography, documentary of George Carlin, I find myself thinking of what Mark Twain said about Wagner. You know, famously he said Wagner's music is better than it sounds. And it's possible that Carlin's comedy is better than it sounds, too, or some version of that. However, our panel will have much to say about that. And then in the second segment, Brigsby Bear, the 2017 feature film by Kyle Mooney, who, after not exactly setting the Saturday Night Live world or stage on fire, is leaving the show, but maybe to do more interesting, quirky little movies. So with us today, well, we have two regular panelists who are stand-up comedians, and then we also have the annually rated the funniest professor of media studies in America. So with us, Sean Murray is a stand-up comedian, writer, and the host of the Nobody Asked Sean podcast. Carolyn Payne is an actress, comedian, dancer, founder, director, choreographer of Kinetic Dance. Bill Usman is professor of media studies at Sacred Heart University. So we are totally ready to go at questions of comedy and what forms and shapes that it takes before we even plunge all the way into George Carlin's American Dream, which, by the way, is actually only, it's a mere 225 minutes long. It's not quite a four, I don't think that's a full 4 hours anyway. I'm bad at math. But let's hear a little clip here. You're going to hear George Carlin. This is from part two of the two-part documentary. You're going to hear George Carlin, followed by the comedian Bill Burr. Cat A1, here we go.
Hey, I'm the first one to say it's a great country, but it's a strange culture. This is a country where gun store owners are given a list of stolen credit cards, but not a list of criminals and maniacs. And now they're thinking about banning toy guns, and they're gonna keep the fucking real ones!
I would say it was like a Miles Davis thing. George has like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 distinct periods of growth where he would leave a segment of his audience behind. Like when he was like working clean from a team to then becoming the counterculture guy, to then being that guy in the 80s, then that dude in the 90s. And each time it was like a boa constrictor. It just got more pointed and more like, man, this guy's scaring the shit out of me. Where is this country going? The courage that that takes to do that.
All right. So let's hear from the panel here. Maybe we just begin with some kind of combination comment on how you've always felt about George Carlin and how you felt about this documentary. Sean, why don't you get us going?
I've always thought Carlin was just one of the greats, you know. But he has that thing where he's like, everyone on both sides thinks he's on their side. And that's what's interesting about him most to me, is that everyone sort of thinks that like, oh, Carlin wouldn't have been standing for this. And then the other side's like, no, Carlin definitely would have been standing for this. And I think it's an interesting thing where he's sort of like very political, but he's also like centrist. And I think that's sort of always led to interesting debates about him. I think he's one of the greats of all time. Like, I think he's probably number three at the lowest for me, but it's interesting to see like how someone who is so pointed is also up for so much interpretation.
Yes, I think that's a great point. Sean, do you think he's centrist or is he kind of both extremes? I mean, there's a way in which, you know, some of his rhetoric is very, very attractive to the left. But as you suggest, some of his rhetoric is attractive to the right as a way of staking out, I would not say centrist positions, but extreme right positions, which, I mean, some of the stuff he says just kind of fits into that shoe too, right?
I guess you're right. I guess he's not centrist, but I guess what I mean is that, like, because he's so far left and so far right, he almost ends up in the middle. Not that he's actually centrist in terms of his opinions, but, like, he's almost, like, non... you can't really classify him as either side. You know, he would say that himself. Like, he doesn't believe in, like, that he's fits either ideology. He's, like, skeptical of both sides, but, like, sort of playing both sides almost puts you in the middle. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, totally. What did you think overall of the documentary, which I'm being told is 3 hours and 45 minutes?
It's a little long. like, in as a fan of Carlin, there's a lot of that I've, you know, sort of already known. Like, it wasn't too many revelations, but it was fascinating to, like, sort of in, like, painstaking almost length chart, like, his growth. I think that's the most fascinating thing about him is that I think Patton Oswalt says, not that he transformed, it's that he almost de-transformed. Like, he started to relax and become his actual self. I love that documentary. We were talking in pre-production about, like, there was not actually a ton of archival footage, so there was a lot of like trying to get around that, which kind of proved that they didn't necessarily need to have it be 4 hours. But I mean, it's Apatow. What are you going to do? This is 40 was like 3 hours.
Yes, that's true. And the Gary Shandling show was 4 hours and 30 minutes. Gary Shandling documentary, which, by the way, I liked better than I like this. But so I clearly am not as troubled by, although I thought at the same time, even with the Shandling thing, I thought Apatow needs to sort of master the idea of editing something anyway. Carolyn, how about you? Just same thing, relationship with Carlin, relationship with this documentary.
So, you know, in watching this documentary, I found myself thinking about how I think the first time I ever saw George Carlin was on Shining Time Station on PBS when I was a little kid.
Right.
So, like, my introduction to him was in such a weird, really, like, non-George Carlin way. And, you know, then obviously, like, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. So it's like I kind of saw him in these actor roles that were sort of this, like, later in his career time. Obviously later I kind of went back in and I had seen, you know, tapes and heard his stand up and everything. So this was kind of interesting to me because, I think like it sort of gave me this history of George Carlin that I didn't have. Like I knew how important I think his work is to stand up comedy and like the history of it and where it is now. But I found this fascinating to watch that journey, although it was really long. And for me to sit through something that's nearly 4 hours long, like that's a lot. but the other thing that kind of fascinated me with this was sort of the era in which he was like working. I mean, it was a very tumultuous time to go through, you know, you had civil rights movement and Vietnam, and it made me kind of think about now. I feel like we're in another historically tumultuous time. And I was trying to think of comedians that are responding to it in the way that I saw it really pivoted his career from what I saw in the documentary of him in his earlier comedy versus where he landed around then. So I was interested. I watched all 4 hours. So again, that's a win.
You know, actually, I think it comes out in the documentary that George Carlin actually got Thomas the Tank Engine hooked on cocaine, which I knew because I was in rehab with Thomas, but I didn't think that was sort of publicly.
I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah. No, the whole show makes a lot more sense when you realize all the drugs that were being done. Also, you know, the fights break out in bars now, whether is it, you know, Carlin, Ringo Starr, who is the best conductor? All right. So, Bill, maybe we could build a little bit on Carolyn's point, because to me, the thing that I found most intriguing, or one of the two things I found most intriguing about this documentary, was the kind of sweep of time, even though I remember Carlin with a crew cut, just watching it, watching the Reagan Revolution transform him, watching, you know, all of these new events kind of affect him. Sometimes he's out ahead of them. Sometimes he's reacting to them. So as a very funny media studies professor, that's got to interest you, because that's part of what media studies kind of is.
Sure. I mean, I do want to stake a claim as one of the professional comedians on this panel, because I know that I am, because my students often write on my evaluations, "This class was a joke."
Yeah.
And so, you know, to me, that's a real win, and I'm getting paid for comedy. But you're right that it is one of the most interesting parts of the documentary, even though, you know, he only lived to, you know, to be 70 or 71. His career did encompass, you know, that whole era from post-World War II, you know, the mid-century 1950s up until, you know, his passing in 2008. And as we've already sort of alluded to, he himself went through many transformations during that time. You heard Bill Burr compare him to Miles Davis and all of his different musical incarnations. I think that's right on. You could also think about people like, you know, dare I say, Picasso, who went through all of these different periods. And you see this in Carlin too. And for me, I'm just a few years younger than you, Colin. He was a impactful of terrible word. He was an important person in my cultural life. As a matter of fact, I used to do a radio show on WWUH in Hartford. And as a brash young man, I decided I was going to play his bit on the seven dirty words during an afternoon show at like 1 o'clock on a Thursday afternoon. And I was kicked off the air and suspended for that. So, you know, there is something that he touched in me and in a lot of people in terms of that irreverence and in terms of that sort of challenging of social norms.
Yeah. So, I mean, I kind of want to talk about what the panel wants to talk about, so I don't want to be over directing this conversation. But Sean, you know, inevitably, particularly at nearly 4 hours long, something like this is going to get also into the kind of the nature of the person's personality and, you know, what might be described as the personal cost. It's either a personal cost of pursuing a life in comedy, or the fact that a person who had the predilection to pursue such a life is going to therefore kind of accrue certain costs. We see his daughter, who strikes me as maybe a little bit damaged by this whole process. We learn things about his marriage. His time on the road seemed to pivot his first wife towards alcoholism. She eventually dies of liver cancer. He goes on the road, bizarrely, while she's dying. I don't know why I'm laughing at that. But there's sort of a, you know, the Carlin, the person, I don't know, he's still a little bit elusive in all of these 4 hours, but you do get the feeling that he's not just angry on stage. He's struggling with life in some way. Sean, I guess wasn't really a question, but I know you'll have something to say.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it all comes from somewhere. You know, you can't just sort of generate that. Like Bill Burr is actually a great example of like someone who he talks about, like, you know, the persona of Bill Burr for so long was like as an angry guy. And then he realized like, oh, I'm actually an angry person. He's talking about he's got to go through therapy in his life. And like, he's not as angry now. And now he has to like, his comedy is evolving in weird ways because he's like, I'm not, people want me to be that same guy now, and I'm going through therapy, and it's like, I gotta have to force it now, and I don't want to force it. And I think that's sort of what, like, with Carlin, like that sort of persona, like that sort of like, he said he's not angry, he has contempt. And I think that contempt is genuine. And I think it had to come from someplace. And he and other comics talk about like he had arrived at that point where like his persona on stage was almost inseparable from his persona off stage. So it doesn't come as a surprise to me that it affected his personal life, because how could it not? Like, I think, like, if you were like someone like his wife or something, like, it would suck to have just try to have a casual conversation about, hey, like, what's going on with the president? And he would just launch into a tirade. Like, it would enough, dude. We're just having a beer.
So, yeah, I'm so glad that you said what you just said, too, because this is kind of a lifetime fascination of mine. And I've discovered that when you're talking to creative people in almost any discipline, a great conversation stopper is something along the lines of what you just said. And I particularly one thing that I've asked a whole bunch of different kinds of people, including Kurt Vonnegut, who came up in our pre-show preparations, is what would happen if creative people took Prozac or something? Or what if there was something that they could do that would suppress some of their demons? Is that something that creative people are afraid to do because they just feel like the whole mechanism feeds off whatever it is that you maybe seek treatment for? And Sean, it you hit it perfectly. The question is, like, what would a happy and well George Carlin be like? Would we even want to see that?
Exactly. And I don't think like him going to therapy would ruin his comedy, but it would have to evolve. You know what I mean? Like, I think as long as the same mind is behind it, I think it could result in something amazing, because he has an amazing mind. It's not just like the contempt that makes him good, but the contempt takes it to another level. So he'd have to find that extra thing, the new thing that would take it to another level. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
So it's you know, but it is a weird thing. Like, people, I know comics, I know artists that would like, oh, I'm not going to therapy. Like, it would mess up everything I do. And it's like, that's kind of like sad. You know what I mean? I don't know.
Right. No, absolutely. So just let's go to A3, just because we're kind of talking around something that Carlin specifically addresses through narration and an excerpt from stand-up in the special. So here's A3.
People will say to me sometimes, well, what are you so angry about?
Has everybody lost their f***ing mind in this country?
What they think is anger is a real contempt for the choices that my fellow humans have made. I just feel betrayed by the bull in America that's all around us. I call it the freak show. When you're born into this world, you're given a ticket to the freak show. When you're born in America, you're given a front row seat.
So Carolyn, in a way, I'm surprised that you didn't chafe at the length of the documentary or at the subject matter. I mean, you and Carlin strike me as different people. I mean, particularly in that level of kind of misanthropy that we hear from him. I mean, his take is so dark and so dire, and it just gets darker and more dire as the years pass. Did that start to bother you at all?
No, honestly, I felt like I understood it more from him. You know, and I think like we're not all that different. I think like a lot of things that I use in my comedy, and one of the reasons I think that I got into comedy was because I had all these things that just like pissed me off all the time. And I mean, I think that we all take our struggles, like comedians all take our struggles and how we see the world and frustrations and quirks and all these things. And build with it. So, you know, yes, Carlin did get very dark with it, but I sort of felt like the comedy that I knew, his like later stuff, sort of, I understood more in watching this, kind of understanding that build. And I mean, I guess there is an element where you question like, how healthy is this to like have this be your art form? But in a lot of senses, I get the feeling that for a comedian like George Carlin, like this was cathartic to him to be out there raging and to have that level of rage. And honestly, Sean, like I would love to have a beer with Carlin where he just like goes off and just goes on a rant. Like I think that there is a magic in people who can do that. And I mean, it's maybe an unhealthy level of rage and use of that kind of desire for change and frustration, but at the same time, I think that that's kind of what's at the root of a lot of great art and artists.
Yeah, I know. I can imagine you and Carlin having a beer at the Spigot. No, let's not start that again. I'm just kidding. Let me get those people upset all over again. So, you know, Bill, I'm going to have you start this a little bit, I think, and then we'll sort of roll into the two comedians with it. To me, one of the big questions with Carlin, and maybe more so with Carlin than any other comedian, except possibly Lenny Bruce, is the question is to what degree are you as a comic, as a comedian, expected to, required to be funny? Are you, to what degree are you judged ultimately on whether or not you're funny? Because there just seem to be moments in Carlin's career where the other thing, however we're going to describe the other thing, mm-hmm. social commentary, a philosophical pursuit of certain kinds of justice, or just a Vonnegut-sized sense of contempt for humankind, are starting to get in the way of and maybe even occupy a higher priority than comedy.
Yeah, I have to say with Carlin, there were times when I did find him very funny, but there are also times where it's more just kind of woeful snickering, if that makes sense. I mean, in terms of our reaction to the things he's saying, that we're sort of like, we're snickering, we're nodding our head, and it is cultural commentary. I have a huge appetite for that. Sure, I want my comedians to be comic. I want, you know, them to make me laugh, but I also do like them to make me think. And I know that works against the grain for some people's perceptions about this, but I think they can go hand in hand very, very well. There is a risk of that. You know, I had like this Twitter argument with somebody or something about Lenny Bruce and how funny you mentioned Lenny Bruce, how funny Lenny Bruce was. And I thought at times Lenny Bruce was really, really funny. And then Lenny Bruce also had his addiction problems and his bitterness. And that starts to erode the funniness. But it also at the same time, I think, makes the cultural critique more sharp and more biting. I personally do embrace that. I'm okay with that. I don't see that as a terrible, horrible flaw.
Yeah, you know, and Sean, so one thing that I brought up in our email correspondences over the last couple of days, you know, Apatow now has made two of these kinds of documentaries. The other one, as I said, Gary Shandling. We know from Apatow's own history that as a teenager, I mean, he wanted to join this community. He wanted to be part of this club. And he is in his own way, although I don't think, you know, anybody thinks of him as a stand-up comedian, but he's certainly part of the comedy ecosystem in a very big way now. But I sort of wonder, like I sent you guys this thing from a Slate article with some of the more transgressive and particularly kind of misogynistic stuff that Carlin did at times, which isn't there in the documentary. I mean, I feel like, you know, in a way, Carlin is famous for his sharp edges. And I think Apatow couldn't quite resist sanding down some of those sharp edges. But Sean, I'd love to know how you took that.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the reasons why it's sometimes a bad idea for someone who is like enamored with the subject. I mean, oftentimes a bad idea for the person who's enamored with the subject to be the person to create the documentary for them, because they're going to see them through those rose-colored glasses. I mean, yeah, Carlin, like, I mean, he's famously sort of like, he's a prickly guy, you know what I mean? And there are a number of bits like in that Slate article that sort of like are not as easy to hail as like brilliant and standing the test of time, because they sort of work against what certain clips in the documentary sort of point to as like what makes him great and progressive or whatever. Like the joke, I think, was it "They're Just Words" or whatever, and yeah, about, you know, the N-word. And it's like, a lot of smart people, especially acolytes of Carlin, do that thing where you're like, I recognize that this word, you know, this word is only has context, and that's why it's powerful. I exist outside that context. I'm going to use it anyway, but you should let me do it because I'm a comedian, and I'm going to make this like, well, you just did the thing you're not supposed to do, but we're supposed to accept it. Like Louis has a very similar bit to that. And it's like, I get what you're trying to do, but also you can you not see why we're not okay with it? And also, but sometimes they, I think Carlin genuinely, at some point, especially like the late Carlin, did not care what you thought about what he was saying.
Yeah, I think you're right. And there's sort of a way in which, you know, there's, you know, ultimately there's this weird kind of algorithm that says if you can make it funny enough, you can do almost anything. You know, if you can really make it funny, redeem it by being funny. But it seems to me that when he loses interest in that algorithm, it's on the one hand kind of interesting to see somebody throw that away and just go, but also somewhat less charming as well. So, Carolyn, we're just about out of time here, but, you know, we're in the middle of yet another national conversation about what comedians can say and what they can't. Chappelle is in trouble for transphobic stuff. Now Ricky Gervais is in trouble for transphobic stuff. John Mulaney is in trouble for letting Chappelle come on stage with him and do transphobic stuff. But, you know, Carolyn, it feels like we're always having some version of that conversation. What's okay? What's not okay? Can you make a joke about this? Can you make a joke about that? And of course, if you're like Anthony Jeselnik, the answer is yes, you can literally make a joke about anything, including something that is really, really not funny. But I'm wondering how you see Carlin in the context of all that.
Well, you know, I think that's a complicated one because I think that Carlin kind of, I think he was one of the first comics to kind of poke the bear in that sense. Like I think he set out to really, you know, try, I mean, he got busted for using foul language on stage and they arrested him for like, you know, that using language like that was getting the crowd riotous, but they, you know, were laughing. And I felt like to me that, at least in this documentary, it was this interesting turning point for him where it was like, oh, so this really provokes everyone. Let's see how much further I can push this. So, and, you know, he talked about being the class clown. That's such like the, you know, like the 10-year-old class clown in like fifth grade who like realizes like, oh, I'm not only going to get a laugh, but I'm going to like get the teacher all riled up. And that's part of the joy of that. And so to me, it was like Carlin was like part of his joy in comedy was like getting people mad at him for doing things that maybe he shouldn't be doing or maybe he shouldn't be saying. And so that was kind of like an interesting thing for me to think about, because I do think like right now we're in this like cancel culture and, you know, comedians are just constantly struggling like what they can and can't say. And you know, it can feel almost like paralyzing. You're like, oh God, if I say this, am I going to just get like blacklisted? Because everyone is so overreactive. And it was interesting to see Carlin just not care. And that was like, I really think part of what he set out to do was really to just kind of push those buttons. And I think we need people like that. We need those like instigators out there. But not when it's hurtful. I think we're seeing some stuff with, you know, like Dave Chappelle and things like that, where the intent feels different.
Yeah. So, yeah. We probably have to stop there, although I'd love to continue this conversation. But it is a nearly 4-hour documentary. It is all about George Carlin. I'm looking to make sure I'm getting the title of it right. George Carlin's American Dream is a 2-part documentary on HBO. I assume it's also on HBO Max. They still haven't figured out how to make their video player work, which is kind of weird. But we'll take a little break. We'll come back. We'll talk about probably kind of a kinder, gentler bit of comedy called Brigsby Bear.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. A lot of people struggle with sleep apnea and with CPAP machines. Dr. Carl Muller, a head and neck surgeon with Hartford Hospital, describes Inspire, a surgical alternative to the CPAP approach.
Only about 60% of patients can tolerate CPAP real well. Inspire is a surgical alternative to CPAP. It's an outpatient surgery. It takes about 2 hours. And essentially what it does is it picks up when you're taking a breath and sends a 2-second electrical pulse to the tongue, which causes the tongue to stick out a little bit and stiffen and prevent the airway from collapsing.
Hartford Hospital has performed more than 200 Inspire therapy surgeries. If you've tried and failed with CPAP, you could be a candidate for this minimally invasive procedure.
Patients with moderate to severe sleep apnea are candidates. There is a weight criteria, so you have to have a body mass index below 35, and you have to have tried and failed CPAP.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
Many factors impact a child's achievement. To start, they need the basics like access to healthy food and quality health care. Join me, Lucy Nalpathanchil, as Connecticut Public and the Connecticut Black and Brown Student Union host a one-hour conversation about the importance of safe housing. Wednesday, May 8th at 6:30 p.m. at the Guard Arts Center in New London. Register at ctpublic.org/safehousing.
We are back. We are talking about comedy in various forms today on the news with a terrific panel consisting of Bill Usman, an acclaimed comic professor of media studies at Sacred Heart University, Sean Murray, a stand-up comedian, writer, and the host of the Nobody Asked Sean podcast. Carolyn Payne is an actress, comedian, dancer, founder, director, and choreographer of Kinetic Dance, as well as other things, too. So we're going to segue from there to Kyle Mooney. Kyle Mooney is leaving SNL, as is Kate McKinnon and Pete Davidson and Adi Bryant. Mooney is the least acclaimed by far of that quartet, although he's always been intriguing to me. I saw some of the work that he did even before he started up with Saturday Night Live. But I also, in 2017, or shortly thereafter, saw this comedy drama written by Mooney and Kevin Costello. It's from a story by Mooney, and it stars him. It's called Brigsby Bear. It is the story of a young man. It's certainly a descendant from the tree of Being There and The Truman Show and Blast from the Past, which is probably not quite equal to some of those other movies. But it's a nice Brendan Fraser and Alicia Silverstone vehicle. But these stories of people, young people raised in usually a young man raised in isolation and then trying to cope with the world that exists outside the strange bubble that he's in. This is kind of the reverse of The Truman Show, which is all about a young man who, unawares, has led his entire life being in a TV show that other people knew about, but he didn't. This is about a young man raised in kind of a bunker situation where his daily diet pretty much was a TV show called Brigsby Bear, which he was under the impression that the rest of the world was watching, when in fact nobody ever saw it except him. It was made for him by his goofy parents, played by Mark Hamill, of all people, and Jane Addams, who is always terrific but is barely in this movie. Before we get the panel going on it, we'll play a little clip. This is so our protagonist, James, played by Kyle Mooney, is finally at the beginning of the movie kind of freed from this bunker that he didn't even really know he was being held in. Winds up being seen by a psychiatrist named Emily, played by Claire Danes. You hear the two of them, plus his actual biological father, played by Matt Walsh, so terrific as the press secretary in Veep. So B1, here we go.
James, the way that the police found you was someone spotted Ted going into a warehouse about 40 miles outside of where he was holding you captive. And inside that warehouse, they found a television stage of a cabin with props and puppets. Do you see where I'm going with this?
Pretty good stuff.
My old dad actually got to go there?
James. Ted Mitchum, your captor. He was the one making the show. James?
Yes! My dad, or my old dad, he knew Brigsby?
I think you're missing the point here, okay?
He was the one who's deciding what Brigsby would do next?
That's right.
Did they figure out who's going to take over doing it?
No one's taking over doing it. You're the only person who's ever seen this show.
All right, and so that's kind of how the plot starts to unfold at that point. Now, oddly enough, I know so much about what this panel thought about George Carlin and nothing about what they thought about Brigsby Bear and Carolyn. That brings up sort of an awkward thing, which is there's a way in which Kyle Mooney's character is this huge fan of a show that nobody else has seen and nobody else could necessarily be expected to relate to, which is essentially my relationship to the movie Brigsby Bear, which I've now seen twice and until now have never talked to anybody who's seen it. And I still don't know what you guys think about it. So you go first.
Wow, Colin, that's really bold. Like, you chose this like obscure movie that you have this like affinity for and then are like, let's talk about it live. I love it. What do you think? That's like one of my fears is like, I have those things that I like secretly love and I hate like bringing them up because I'm just afraid everyone's going to trash them. But you know what, Colin, you will be happy to know that this does not fall into the movies that I had to watch for the nose that I totally hated. It was weird, but in like kind of a wonderful way. So I get it. I get your love for this movie. It definitely reminded me of like Blast from the Past and, you know, Napoleon Dynamite and Hamlet 2, which I don't know if any of you have seen. That's my weird reference movie. But it's a fun watch. It's chill. It has this amazing cast. It's really funny to see like Mark Hamill in a role like this. Greg Kinnear is always, I mean, it's just like everyone is a really sparkly performer in this and doesn't play it in this like over the top way. The whole movie is kind of understated, but it works. And so I get why a movie like this would stick with you. It wouldn't be something that I would, you know, bring up and start talking about. Power to
well, yeah, no, this is of course, that's very much the part of the premise of the movie is that Kyle Mooney does bring this thing up and talks to people as though he kind of expects them to love it or be okay with it. He eventually does find at least one person, a very nice young man named Spencer, who kind of shares some of his enthusiasm. But, you know, Bill, in a way, this is kind of a yin-yang conversation. There's a way in which the sweetness that pervades this movie, it starts with this incredibly grim premise, but then is pervaded by a sweetness, not just from Kyle Mooney's character, but the way people around him. Kinnear as this cop who also has like these theatrical ambitions that were thwarted and stuff. I don't know. There's something, maybe I just need a movie that's this nice.
Yeah, you nail it. Like, I was just sitting here thinking that these are mirror images of each other, but you probably put it better when you say yin yang, because this really had, this does counter all of the George Carlin bitter with, as you say, really, really sweet. But I think it avoids being cloying. Like, I think it's very charming. It's a very charming film, but for me, that's often not really that much of a compliment. I do veer more toward the bitter, but I think it skirts around that. It doesn't fall into that trap of being cloying, and it's, you know, it's just it's both sad and funny. It's weird. Sometimes it's really cringy. It's poignant. You know, he's so much of an outsider. And I think that is very much about what it's really about, being an outsider, the loss of innocence. There's this scene at a party, which is just so hard to watch, but for me, at least, it was hard to watch because, true confession, I kind of have been that guy, James, played by Kyle Mooney, at that party, just not knowing how I'm going to like get into the flow of things and making mistakes as I try to do that. And so I think it does speak to something that a lot of us have felt. And, you know, I think the similarity is that you know, Carlin and Mooney were both kind of, I assume Mooney, outsiders in some ways, but that status of being an outsider can go in these very different directions.
Yeah. And Sean, I mean, there's sort of some universality there too. I mean, I think we've all, well, maybe not you, you're sort of, you're cooler than most of us, but we've all been sort of the guy at the party who's interested in something that a lot of other people at the party aren't interested in, and we don't necessarily know where all the signposts are or the guardrails or you know, how to maybe navigate a social situation. I think this movie gets some of that stuff right in a very interesting way. But I also just want to know whether you liked it, whether you thought it was good.
Oh, I loved it. I've been meaning to watch this movie for years, and I just kept putting it off, and then it wasn't on streaming for a while. Then it finally was on streaming, well, somewhere for free. I think it was on Amazon, and I didn't feel like paying $3.99 or whatever. So, one of the reasons I liked it is because it really gets what makes Kyle Mooney very funny, and like what makes him like an interesting performer is like sort of he's like a child, you know what I mean? Like, even he used to do these things before SNL, is these YouTube videos, the Inside SoCal Quick Hits, and he was playing this like sort of San Diego surfer dude who was just sort of a childlike idiot. Like, he would do interviews with people around, and they were so funny because it was like, you can't hate this guy because he's like, is he okay? I mean, is this an adult or is this a child? You know, and that's sort of like the Briggsby Bear, like at the center of it is that things like he's still a child. And in this case, he's a child because he's been forced to be a child because he's only ever watched a child show. But it's like that quote where it's like, if you judge a goldfish on how to ride a bike, I don't know what the Einstein quote is, but it's like, you know, everybody has their skills. And like SNL, just to get on that conversation, sort of like forces people to be a certain thing. And so many people are successful on SNL or once they leave SNL and they do their own thing, like Tim Robinson would, I think we should leave. It's like, he would never really flourish on SNL, but when he was writing his own stuff, he was able to do it and be more successful than he would have ever been on SNL. So I think it's fascinating. Like, that's my favorite thing about the movie, is that like, oh, like it reminded me, because I liked Kyle Mooney before SNL. I was like, why didn't they just do more stuff like this? But there's no room for it on SNL.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad you went there. Because I've been thinking about that a lot. You know, SNL sort of, you know, started way back when I was in college, which is like a really long time ago, you know, and it kind of positioned itself as a place where kind of non-mainstream comedy, not ready for primetime players, was going to happen, and it was going to be experimental. And in some ways, if you look at the early stuff, it kind of was very risk-taking. But Sean, I do feel like over the years, they've kind of developed a set of invisible guardrails, you know, and it still leaves a wide expanse in which to create comedy, but there's also quite a lot that falls outside it. And I feel the same way. I sort of wonder if Kate McKinnon's going to have a terrific career. She will if she can develop her own stuff the way Tina Fey and Amy Poehler and Kristen Wiig do. But there's a way in which a guy like Mooney, who really wanted to try something different, almost didn't belong on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, exactly. It's a sort of thing where, like, he knows his strengths, right? But, like, SNL doesn't necessarily need his strengths every night. They need what's going to make a good show. And, like, you know, like you said, it used to be they're not ready for primetime players, but then it became an institution. SNL is the premier sketch comedy show in the world. I mean, this is an American sort of centric mindset. There's probably just something in France that's way bigger, but I don't watch that show because I don't even know if it exists. But I think, like, Kate McKinnon is has great live wire energy. She has some great sketches on SNL. But like, I remember in the Ghostbusters movie that came out in 2016, which wasn't much of a fan of, but I thought everyone in it was great, gave great performances. Kate McKinnon most especially. But it's like, when you only get any opportunities to do that, and she's just weird. She's just a very weird performer. And it's like, sometimes there's usefulness in that. Most often on like something like Weekend Update, where you could just, your whole character can just be weird person with weird voice and bouncing off of Colin Jost, who's like, you know, a stick in the mud. So it's perfect. But I don't know. I would love to see like more opportunities for the like weirder performers to get opportunities to do something actually cool and funny and good, like Briggsby Bear.
All right, we have to stop there. Brigsby Bear is the movie. You can find it. Search for it on your cable system. I forget. Did we watch it on Hulu? I can't remember what we watched it on. But it's available, I think, also with ads on some things. And you'll find it. Brigsby Bear, if you want it. We'll be back after this. He's daring and caring and knows so much more. It's Brigsby Bear. He travels the skies and the stars through the night. He battles Sun Snatcher with all of his might. He's strong, never wrong, cause he always does right. It's Brigsby Bear. Okay, quick like a bunny, I got to thank Kat Pastor. She's our technical producer, the person who keeps us on the air and sounding good. Jonathan McPants is always the producer of The Nose, and he is the producer of This Nose. It's time to make some recommendations with our wonderful panel. Carolyn Payne, why don't you get us started?
All right. Well, I mentioned this earlier because something about Brigsby Bear, maybe it was the haunting Brigsby Bear theme that will probably, that will stick with me. So thanks for that and playing it again. But this movie reminded me, something about it reminded me of Hamlet 2, which came out a long time ago now. And it's Steve Coogan, Catherine Keener, Amy Poehler, David Arquette, Elizabeth Shue. And it's about this high school drama teacher who is a failed actor himself, who takes on writing a sequel to Hamlet and having his ragtag ensemble of high school actors perform this epic Hamlet sequel. And it is, this is actually one of my favorite movies that I very rarely talk about. So Colin, this is my Brigsby Bear. And it's really well done. Maybe the theater nerd inside me loves it more than others would. But I feel like if you like Brigsby Bear humor, you would enjoy Hamlet too. So check that out.
I've actually seen it and I agree. And Coogan is great in it. All right. So Bill Usman, why don't you go next?
I know the theme today is comedy. I'm not going to do that. Sorry, I'm a bad boy. I'm going to recommend something really, really dark, but I think quite impressive. I'm currently watching a TV series called Under the Banner of Heaven, which is a true crime drama based on a nonfiction book by John Krakauer about a murder that took place in a Mormon community. It stars Andrew Garfield, who I think is really terrific in it as a person who is suffering with a crisis in faith because of this investigation. And it really gets into, I think, some important issues about fundamentalist religion and the problems that can occur from that sort of thing. And not incidentally, because it's such an important part of it, it's got great music by Jeff Ament, who is the guitarist from Pearl Jam. And this is his first experience actually creating the score for a television series. And I just think the whole thing is really, really terrific from start to bottom. That's Under the Banner of Heaven.
Right. So I started it and then I stopped. And then I started referring to it as Mormon Spider-Man, which I know is not a good thing to call it. But
not fair.
You've made me want to start it up again. So thanks
Go
for doing that.
Go back to it. Yeah.
Sean Murray, what are you going to recommend to us? Oh, we might have lost John.
There you are.
Okay.
I'm going to recommend something that no one is going to actually check out. It's a 2.5-hour video on YouTube called The Line Goes Up by this guy called Floating Ideas. And it's basically about why our NFTs are BS and just a plot to keep power with the wealthy. And it's one of the most fascinating things I've seen in years. And like I said, it's 2.5 hours. No one's going to watch it. But if you do, you'll thank me.
What, see the name of it again, Sean?
It's called Line Goes Up. Holding ideas.
All right. So I'm going to endorse not a comedy thing either, although somewhat later in style anyway than Under the Banner of Heaven. And that is the 10-episode new version, kind of total remake of The Lincoln Lawyer. It's on Netflix right now. This is not some kind of great feat of prestige TV, but it's pretty good. The guy who's playing the lead role, sort of the role that was formerly done by Matthew McConaughey, but really a completely different imagining of this whole character, is a guy named Manuel Garcia Rufo, who you might have seen in Goliath and a whole bunch of other stuff, but like really could wind up becoming a star as a result of this. It has a great cast, including Becky Newton, who's in been a couple of things. I don't really know her, although it turns out she's from Guilford, Connecticut, so I kind of would. And then is, I don't know whether it's never Neve Campbell, I've never known, but I've always wanted to see her in something that wasn't a horror movie. She's terrific in this, and on and on. Oh, an actor named Jazz Rako, she's just terrific as the driver of the Lincoln Lawyer. So I really recommend this. It's, you know, if you want something that maybe isn't quite as challenging, that's just sort of a really interesting legal thriller whodunit, not quite as challenging as Under the Banner of Heaven, probably not quite as prestigious either, I would totally recommend that. We are going to end the show today with sort of something other than our usual theme. This will be a song by Depeche Mode. This is because, as you probably know, the keyboardist, Andy Fletcher, died yesterday. He was 60.